Welcome back to the Laravel podcast. This week I'm talking with Mohammed Saeed, Laravel's first employee, but he's also a free diver who lives in what looks like a vacation paradise. Stay tuned to learn more. All right, welcome back to the Laravel podcast. We're, you know, I'm not even going to be counting these interviews. Who knows which number? Number 50 trillion podcast episode, season three. Words. I don't even know. I've got Mohammed Saeed. So Mohammed has done quite a few interviews because it's really special. He's the first employee of Laravel, and Laravel is the most popular PHP framework. It's got a lot going on for it, and it's kind of like a one-man show. There's this idea of the BDFL, the benevolent dictator for life, being Taylor Otwell. So we both have, first of all, the first non-Taylor person working for Laravel, who's Mohammed. But we also have the first idea where you see an open source framework, you know, you're comparing to an Angular or an Ember or someone else like that, who just kind of has like the BDFL and then hired an employee. I mean, Taylor, you know, created Laravel LLC, which is a company named Laravel, and that company has an employee. And so it's a little bit of a different working arrangement. And also a lot of people hadn't heard of Mohammed when he got hired. And so he's actually already had an interview in the Laravel News podcast. He's already been interviewed by Stack Overflow. But I'm hoping that we're going to be able to cover a little bit more and a little bit of different things, maybe. I don't want to cover exactly the same territory, but I just wanted to point out if you've never heard of Mohammed before, you obviously have never put in an issue or a pull request to the Laravel core, because he's really been kind of very active in all those spaces for quite a while, together, of course, with a team of volunteers. He also writes on Medium. He also develops his own features. He's also got a couple other packages. Mohammed is a man around the Laravel community that's been doing a lot of stuff. So I'm really excited to get to talk to him. So before I start asking you questions, Mohammed, why don't you say hi and just kind of give us the basic pitch of who you are and what you're about. When you first meet someone, you know, how do you tell them like what you're about and what you're interested in, what you do and where you're from and anything else? And then say whatever you got to say, and then we'll go from there.
Well, first, my name is Mohammed Saeed, and I live in Hurghada, Egypt. Hurghada is a small city on the Red Sea. I work as a web developer at Laravel with Taylor Otwell. I've been working with Taylor for the past year or so, and that's pretty much how I describe myself to listeners of a podcast about Laravel. But one of the things that I usually mention when I speak with anyone is that I love to dive into the ocean. So that's, if I am a Laravel developer, I'm also a free diver, and that's the two parts of me. So that's me.
Very cool. I think that when I follow you, I think that the three things I get about you are, I get that you love to dive. And I mean, it just, I don't know anything about that, so I definitely have some questions for you there. I know that you're married, and you'll often reference your wife. Actually, in one of your interviews, you mentioned that of the things you tend to do, it's program, dive, and shop with your wife. So I might go somewhere there. And then that you live in Egypt. Oh yeah. Programming, diving, and then your wife, and shopping with your wife. So you didn't originally live in Hurghada. Is that where you were originally? And then once you started working with him, you moved to Hurghada. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, I'm originally from Cairo, and okay. I lived there all my life until like 1 year ago. But like Cairo is, it's like a group of four large cities that grew up massively to become one large, huge city. So You kind of like find a huge crowd of people in every corner. So it became a little, it became very crowded and very noisy. So me and a couple of friends, we tried to think like other options if we would like to live in a better place or so. And each one of us picked like one of the cities that he would like to move to. And my choice was Hurghada, because I love being around the sea. I love meeting different kind of people. And the interesting thing about Hurghada is that it's full of foreigners, like tourists and residents who are not from Egypt. So That's very interesting for me because, like, I get to meet people from different nationalities and I get to make friends from different point of views and so on. And that's why I picked Hurghada. And me and my wife, we traveled to Hurghada for 2 weeks to test the waters. And we really liked it so much. And we decided just to move. Maybe that was December 2016, around a year ago.
Right. Okay. And so I love learning about where people are from and what they're about. So one of the things that I did was I opened up Kayak for looking up flights. And I just said, you know what, if I were to leave out of Orlando, which is my closest kind of major international airport, and I were to go to Hurghada, what would it take? And what it told me was the affordable option is around $1,000 US. And that is a multi-stage flight with going through JFK and then I think Cairo. So obviously it says Hurghada International Airport, but it's obviously not big enough that I could fly directly into it. But it's a big enough airport that I could basically go out of my next major, you know, hub, which is JFK for me, and then over to Cairo and then over to Hurghada. It would take me about 19 hours to get there. Have you ever considered, and we'll go lots of different places, have you ever considered pulling a Michael Dorinda and all those other folks and kind of flying the whole way over to US for Alaricon? Is that something that might be in the cards for you one day?
Yeah, I definitely do it. I tried to do that for like the past couple of Alaricons, but I couldn't really arrange it for myself to fly to the States, but I definitely do it if I get the chance.
Cool. All right. So Hurghada. So I love kind of getting context about things. So Hurghada is a touristy kind of beach city. It's right on the Red Sea. And it's so Cairo is it's a big kind of metropolitan hub. You said it's four cities that have kind of grown up together. And it's really massive. Hurghada, does it feel very big?
Like Hurghada, it's not very big and not very small. Like you can drive around Hurghada in less than 30 minutes from the beginning of the city to the end of it, because it's like two rows on the sea. So if you are working on the you are driving on the street that's directly on the sea from the start to the end, you just can do it in 30 minutes. So it's not very big and not very small. But it has like a lot of different kind of people from different nationalities. So that makes it like feel even more rich than Cairo. Like in Cairo, you get to meet a lot of people everywhere. It's very crowded. Hurghada is not as crowded, but with the diversity, it makes it a rich city, not just a small city that you just go and relax. There are a lot of activities and a lot of people to meet here. And yeah, that's why I like it in the first place.
Yeah, it seems like the best of both worlds, where it's both kind of small. I mean, there's only somewhere around 250,000 people, which I complain about how small Gainesville is where I live, and the Gainesville metro area is over 250,000 people. But it's also spread out, so they're not super compact. But it also, one of the problems with Gainesville is it's hard to get anywhere, and there's just like, there's not as much of like an international vibe, which you just mentioned. So you're getting a small, easily travelable place where the population density isn't too high. You're meeting people from all over. And I mean, anybody who's listening to this, but just pause for a second and go Google Hurghada, H-U-R-G-H-A-D-A, and just go to Google Images. And it's just luxurious, beautiful, blue and teal ocean vista after vista after vista. It's just gorgeous. And I mean, you could also just follow Mohammed on any social media platform and you'll know pretty much all he's doing is just like being in a vacation commercial every single day. Like every picture you get is just you diving through the most beautiful water I've ever seen. It's kind of unbelievable. So
yeah, the water here is very amazing.
So there's a lot of people who live, you know, a couple, I mean, so Hurghada is 5 hours away from Cairo. So there's a lot of people who are 5 hours away from just absolutely beautiful vacation destinations. And there's a lot of different things that kind of hold us back from doing what you did, just kind of pulling up your roots and moving to this beautiful place where you can do these things you want. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that might have kept you from moving over there. So for starters, is your family all still back in Cairo? And if so, has it been hard being so far away from them, or was that a pretty easy decision to make?
No, it wasn't easy because like it took us 2 years to make the move because like all the family and friends are living in Cairo, and Also, I had to be in Cairo for work purposes. I just started working remotely like 1 year before the move. So we had a lot of attachments in Cairo, either me and my wife, because she used to work at a teaching assistant in the university in Cairo. So it took us like around 2 years for us to get ready for the move. And I keep telling my friends I keep encouraging them to get out of Cairo and try to experience other places. But I know how difficult it can be. So I just hope like that people just give it a chance, like and try to move there for like a limited amount of time, not just to make the final decision, just to try it for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or so before they can know if they feel good about it, that they can sacrifice all the attachments that they have in Cairo and move to a new city, or it's just not doesn't worth it. So I try to convince people to make the move, but it's not easy. I understand that.
Yeah. So when you decided to do that 2 week trip, I think that's a really cool idea, that going somewhere for 2 weeks to try it out. Were you just living in a hotel, or was it something like an Airbnb, or how were you able to just kind of move to a place for a short term?
Yeah, we used Airbnb to find a nice apartment. It wasn't like you mentioned that Hurghada is a luxurious city. It's not like what you see on the internet. What you see on the internet is the photos of the hotels and resorts.
Right. Right.
But actually, the city is like a city in Egypt, and we can like it or not, but Egypt is a third world country. Like, it's not very clean and not very well taken care of, but it's definitely a nice wild place on the sea. So that's how I describe it. It's a wild place on the sea. So when we moved there for 2 weeks, we tried to pick an apartment at the heart of the city, not in any of the luxurious areas or places that has lots of hotels and lots of resorts. Just a place in the middle of the city itself, just to know the people, just to know how life is in the city, the actual city, not the touristic place. So.
Right.
Yeah, that's. I think that was wise enough for us to understand the actual city, not just the luxurious places if we stayed in a hotel or so.
Yep. Yeah, and the reason I specifically said I didn't say Hurghada is beautiful. I said when you look up Google Images, it's beautiful, and that's exactly kind of what you pointed out, which is that there's often a difference. The interesting thing is the more I guess first world it is, the more likely it is that if there's natural beauty, then the cost and also the kind of quality of the places that you can live around the beautiful thing is more necessarily higher. Like, there's not a lot of really, really, really beautiful beaches in the US, maybe none, where you can live close enough to the beach that you can just kind of walk or maybe drive for 5 minutes and have a place that you could describe the way you just described Hurghada, right? Because if there's a beach, then that means there's, you know, a beautiful beach, at least. That means there's incredibly expensive ocean high rises all along the way that are really, 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 really costly. And anybody who's got access to a beach like that is probably paying quite a premium. I mean, I visited Miami very recently, and they're extremely expensive. So I'm looking at an Airbnb in Hurghada, and just literally the first result that came up, studio with free private beach. It's not a beautiful place, you know, can fit two people. It's not, you know, probably a couple hundred square foot, but it's $17 per night. And if you compare what that looks like to somewhere in Florida, it's just kind of mind boggling to me. And so I told you before we started this call that you have the opportunity to just say, you know what, I don't want to discuss that. I'm not going to ask you how much money you're making, but I do want to ask kind of a broader question of, does working for a US-based company, did that make it easier to move somewhere like Hurghada? Did that give you a little bit more financial flexibility because you're getting paid a little bit closer to American rates, but living at Egyptian costs? Or is the cost of living not so different that made a big impact?
Yeah, it definitely made a huge difference. Like before I started working at Laravel, the decision to move to a different city, not having any friends or any family around to help in case I needed any kind of help, that was like terrifying. But like the financial security that it gives you like a feeling of security. Like that's how you can describe it, that you can afford living in a place like Hurghada. It's not very, even for an Egyptian having a normal Egyptian salary, Hurghada is not very expensive. Like what you see in Airbnb, it's like the price or the cost for foreigners.
Got it.
Yeah, in Hurghada there are like everything has two prices. One price for foreigners and the other for Egyptians.
That's hilarious.
I know that's not fair, but that's how
it is. That's life.
Yeah, that's how it because like if I have an apartment in Hurghada and I want to rent it to someone, if I don't rent it to Egyptians and I only put prices for that where foreigners can afford, Egyptians won't ever be able to rent my apartment, and it will be like empty for the most of the year. So people like put prices for everything, even gifts, even in the shops, they put prices in dollars or euros, or the equivalent in Egyptian pounds to dollars and euros. But if you're an Egyptian and you go and try to buy something, they give you a different price because they know that you can't afford that high price that they give to foreigners and tourists. So yes, Hurghada is a touristic city, but that kind of separation between foreigners and Egyptians, it made it a bit easier for me to make the decision. The financial security that I'm having from my current job, it made a big difference. Yeah, I can't deny it.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit in one of your other interviews, and just for anybody who knows, there's two interviews that I'm referencing. He was interviewed in the Laravel News podcast, and he was interviewed on the Stack Overflow blog. I'll link both of those in the show notes. So go take a look at those, because I'm not going to try and cover the same kind of stuff that they were covering there. But one of the things that you mentioned is that you had done swimming, and then your trainer pushed you a little bit too hard and you almost kind of had stopped swimming for a while. What was it that got you back into swimming after you had that kind of negative experience with it?
We used to go to the sea every summer when I was like a kid, but like 7 years or maybe back, my father, he got sick and he had problems with his business and he had to close it down, shut it down. They were like tough years, so we didn't get the chance to go to the sea for a few years. But but then when I first like got engaged to my wife, we had a trip with her family, and I joined them. It was like in Hurghada here in a hotel on the beach, and we just got into the sea, and I wanted to impress my fiancée like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I tried to swim and like to look cool while swimming so that she gets impressed. And that's when I discovered that I need to get back to swimming, and I really like swimming and I really like the sea, and I need to get back to learning how to swim better. And that's pretty much how it started.
That's cool. And so when did you make the switch from swimming to realizing that diving was something you're interested in? What was that like?
Again, my wife, for the reason, because she likes to collect seashells, and I used to swim and try to dive and bring her seashells from like 2 meters or 3 meters deep. And then I realized that I love diving, because when you dive, you get closer to the fish and get closer to the marine life. And I look cool as well. So...
Yeah, you sure do.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
That's again because of my wife.
That's very cool. I don't know what made me think about this, but I started wondering about the languages. I don't know what put that in my brain, but I assume that the common language that everyone speaks and everything. Oh, it's because you mentioned putting things in English and U.S. dollars in the windows is Arabic. But what was learning English like for you? Is that something that you learned in schools, or is it an intentional decision that you made? Or do you speak English a lot better than the folks you know? Or is this kind of your level of fluency pretty common?
Well, in Egypt, everybody learns English in schools. Like there are two types of schools. They call it the new system or the experimental system and the old system. The old system is Arabic only. They only learn English when they are like not very young. But the school I went to, we used to have an English class from since I was like 5 or 6 years old. So that really like helped a lot. But then later, I kept watching like a lot of TV movies, a lot of movies and a lot of TV series in English, and listen to music and songs or so, and that made me like collect a good amount of vocabulary. And I know I have a heavy accent, and I'm not as fluent as I am while I'm writing English. I write better than speaking because like I don't get to practice English a lot.
Sure.
Yeah, but I think like among like my folks, we are all on the same level because we all like get to learn English in schools.
That's cool. And just for what it's worth, you don't have a heavy accent. You have an accent, but you don't have a heavy accent. But further, I think there's a difference between an accent and fluency. You are extremely fluent. I mean, there's nothing that would suggest that you're having any trouble conveying your words. So that often is the difference between either a school system that introduces it really early or someone who's kind of taken extraordinary efforts to kind of learn the language. So that's really really cool to hear that there's schools where they're really kind of starting it so early and making it so intensive. I've spoken to a lot of people about the impact that many or most programming things being in English has. And I actually asked for a while to people, what would it be worth me building into the CMS that powers my website the ability to have like a translated version into multiple translations for each of my blog posts? And of course, the people who follow me are willing to speak English because otherwise, why follow me on Twitter? So I got a little bit of a biased sample because they all said, don't worry, you just need to learn English to program. Have you seen any, or do you have any thoughts about non-English programming education or anything like that? Or are you in the camp that just says, you know what, if you're going to do code, you got to learn English. That's just a part of the deal.
Yeah, I think that if you are going to do code, you'll have to learn English. And that's why I keep telling to everyone around, because like the problem is like the content of the tutorials and learning content online is all in English. And if you choose not to learn English just because you don't like it or you don't think it's very important, you're missing a lot. I'm not saying that people should learn the language because like it's the language of the world and so on. Like people have different opinions about that around the world. But if you are a programmer, and if you don't want to learn English, you are missing a lot. And the number of programmers or the number of people who have blogs and post videos online who are willing to translate their content is not that big. So you right. definitely need to learn English in order for you to get all, to get access or to have access to all this content online.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of access to the content, I know that one of the things that impacts people's ability to kind of learn programming, especially in our generation where there weren't a lot of resources for programming when we were a little bit younger, is when those resources kind of and the internet are made available in their country. You know, I think it's a little bit more ubiquitous now than it was 10, 20 years ago. So one of the things that you'd mentioned was you'd said something along the lines of basically when the internet became widely available in Egypt was when you were, I think you were 12 or 13 or something, and you instantly latched onto Flash. Could you tell me, you talked a little bit about your journey from Flash to HTML to PHP and WordPress, and so I don't want to double cover that, but what I'm, I think, a little more interested in is what was it like culturally to go from, you know, what was like prior to that, and I don't know what your level of access to the internet was prior to after that, not even just as a programmer, but just kind of daily life. What was it like? What was that shift like, and how universal and how abrupt was the shift where you felt like you did not and then later did have access to the internet?
Well, before that, like you just know people, just limited amount of people around you, and you only get to know other people or other thoughts or other experiences from TV. And the thing about TV is that it's all managed. Like, I mean, it's not natural. Like, you open a channel and you see what the channel wants you to see. So
right.
it was like a bit limited, and you don't get to choose what idea you need to follow. You just have to open, you just open the TV and you see programs that you must watch, or that's the only option you can have.
Right.
You have to watch these programs in this sequence and so on. But after I got exposed to the internet and I tested it the first time, actually the first few times I had to open the internet, my father was there with me and I was sitting beside him, and he opened Yahoo and he taught me how to search, how to write a search term and how to find information about, like back then I was interested in maybe animals, like I know I want to know more about giraffes, I want to know more about elephants, and so on. And he taught me how to do search and how to find the information I need. And I started like getting into this world on my own and try to find things that I'm interested in and try to learn more about it. And back then there was no YouTube and not much entertainment as far as I can remember. It wasn't like a tool for entertainment as it is now. Like it wasn't very, very much like full of the videos and the photos like before. It was just maybe all websites were like text-based and you just get to know information about a specific topic or so. And that's how I started. But then I knew about chatting and I started using Yahoo Chat. There was like a room for web designers, and I think that this room or this period of my life where I started to chat with people, it made a huge impact on who I am right now, because like when you get to meet people from outside your world or universe, like people from different countries, and they are focused on speaking about a single topic, which is web design. It's not like a general chat where everybody's talking about everything. It's just a focused room full of people from different nationalities. And I was maybe 13 or 14 years old back then, and getting to know people or to chat with people who are much, much older than me and much more experienced. And I felt like I'm not very very amateur. I can discuss topics and I can get into conversations and I can have my own opinions, and that gave me like a kind of confidence that I think it's many people, especially here in Egypt, lack, is that they always feel like they are not valuable enough or not good enough to contribute or not good enough to be able to discuss a certain topic, because maybe because it's their first time to, I don't know, I can't actually explain why people think like it, but it gave me, like interacting with people and speaking with them at this young age, it gave me the confidence I need.
That's really cool to hear. So if, let's say, whether through you sending this to all your friends or maybe just the natural reach of this podcast, let's say we got, you know, 100 young Egyptian women and men who are hearing you saying this, and they say, I identify with everything that Muhammad just said. I feel like I don't have anything to contribute, or I don't know how to contribute, or whatever. That's not how we want them to feel. That's not how you want them to feel. That's not how I want them to feel. I know it's not how Taylor or other members of the community want them to feel. We want them to feel like they, just like anybody in any other country, whether the US or anywhere else, are welcome and have something to contribute. So is there something you could say to them or some advice you could give to them that would help them? And this is not just for folks in Egypt, it's for anybody else in a similar country, but let's, for your sake, target people in Egypt, young people in Egypt, who feel the same way that you just described, where they just don't know how to contribute or that they don't feel like they're good enough, whatever. Could you either give them a piece of advice or say something to them to help them kind of move past that?
Well, I think that if you are like on an online forum where people discuss web development or the topic or the area you are interested in, and you just decided or you saw a post where you have an answer to, or you have a reply, or you have a point of view, and you just write on your keyboard whatever you have in mind, the problem is the click on the post button. That's the problem. That's what's stopping everyone. Many people, like I know for sure that they see something in Laravel or any of the other repositories, and they try to contribute or to ask a question or require a change or something, and they go all the way until they even open the pull request, but they just don't publish it. They just keep it or stop at this level. So my advice or what I won't say is that just keep it out there. Nobody will judge you. Even if you have a question and you think it's stupid, you just have to go into the forums and see how many stupid questions out there. I myself, I post a lot of stupid questions everywhere. And I feel like the first few times when I got hired at Laravel, I thought like I can't be an employee at Laravel and just go to the forums and ask questions about Laravel. That will make me look like I was like a misfit or it was a mistake to hire me. But then I decided that I'll just go ahead and continue whatever I was doing, and I'll just keep posting questions. And some of these questions are really stupid. Like some of them are, I can't really find the answer if I look myself very deep, but it's just how people are pelt to be. We are pelt to live together and share what we think and just interact with each other. So I just post it and don't feel embarrassed or anything.
That's really great advice. I really appreciate you sharing that. And I think it's an interesting inverse, because I think a lot of people say, well, I don't know what I'm doing and I don't want to ask a question. But it's funny, because the more your reputation grows, actually, the more you feel like you don't have the freedom to ask those questions, just like you mentioned. And once you felt a lot more free asking questions before you had first employee of Laravel next to your name. And then all of a sudden, once you do, you now have, oh, well, I got to know these things. You know, I remember when I signed a contract with O'Reilly to write Laravel up and running, that, you know, one of the first Laravel books with a major tech publisher, I instantly had this feeling that like, well, now I got to do everything on my own because I can't be seen asking these questions. And it's totally true. Like, I think that the best, not only the best learning, but even some of the best teaching to other people requires us to start from a place of assuming that like where we are is okay, and revealing that that's where we are is not going to hurt us. Because often, like, you're not even just learn, you're not capable of teaching something to other people until you reveal the fact that that's something that you just learned. And so sometimes you're scared to teach something to someone because you say, well, what if they realize, what if they say, oh, duh, everybody knows that. Well, then you don't share that thing. So it doesn't just limit you from learning. It even limits you from helping other people. And you mentioned that with the pull requests and stuff. So, I totally affirm, what Muhammad just said is, we really welcome people to just kind of be where they are, and that's okay. And I think the biggest thing, like some folks, you know, if you end up going into the LaraChat Slack or Laravel IRC or the GitHub issues or anything else like that, you'll notice that like people with the simplest of questions who are kind and respectful are just helped like crazy. And people with really complicated questions or who are trying to show off how much they know, who are disrespectful or unkind, aren't helped so much. It's very much like if you treat people the way you want to be treated, as long as you're kind and as long as you're respectful, I don't think there's any, you know, such a thing as a bad question in that context. So let's do a quick break before we change topics. Your Twitter handle, I have always read it as the M Saeed, like the M Saeed. Is that actually what it is? What is your Twitter handle and your GitHub handle actually representing?
Well, it's my name is Mohammed Saeed. And when I was young, I used to have all my usernames everywhere as M Saeed, as M Saeed. But then I don't remember what happened, but for like a year or so, I stopped being interested in the internet and stuff. And I remember like closing my accounts or just ignoring them until they got deactivated from on their own. And then when I came back again, I tried to register accounts from the start, and the username msite wasn't available. So the second option...
the worst.
Yeah. So the second option was like the msite, but I pronounce it as themsite.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. That was my next question, was now that I know the source of it, how do you pronounce it? So that's how you pronounce it, like it was them.
Yeah, them say it. It's easier this way.
Yeah, that's funny. All right. So again, I don't want to dig too far down this direction, but one of the things that I had mentioned to you before was that when there was a time, probably 3 to 6 months prior to when you got hired by Laravel, where you came out of nowhere. You know, nobody had really heard your name, or not, at least not folks in the US. And all of a sudden, you were making pull request after pull request after pull request. You were communicating extremely well. You were writing good code. They were extremely useful pull requests. And we just kind of like said, well, who is this guy and where is he coming from? And so I remember that when Laravel, or when Taylor started hiring for the first Laravel employee, one of the things I said was, this Muhammad guy is someone you want to take a look at. And it wasn't my recommendation that got you the job or anything like that. But I definitely was, I put a vote in your favor because I was just so impressed with how useful your pull requests were and how good your code was and how well you were writing them. The way I've kind of thought about it was that you were at a job where you were using Laravel and you were, I think it was something about collections or pagination or something where you just had a very specific set of needs and you just ran into situations and you kind of have the mind to say, well, it doesn't do what I want, so I'm going to write them. Do I have the right story in my head? Is that where all that came from? You basically jumped into a new code base as Laravel, you found missing things and you pull requested them?
Yeah, it was basically in the validator. And I was working on a project where I need, where I had to do a lot of array validation, and I just discovered this tiny bug in an edge case, and I thought to myself that I can fix it. Like I know what went wrong, and I know how the code works internally, so I can fix it. So I tried to just make the changes on my vendor's folder, just not doing any pull requests or something, and I got it to work. I tested it on my code, and it was working. So the next step, I saw that it might be useful that these changes or these fixes that I did to be published on Laravel so that everyone else can use them. And I just opened GitHub and read about how to open a pull request, and that's how I got my first pull request open. And it was rejected because the code, it was fixing something, but it was breaking something, another thing. But
right.
After some time, like I opened another pull request maybe the next day, and that one got merged. So that's how it started.
So those pagination pull requests that you put in that I watched happen, those weren't just your first pull request to Laravel. They were your first open source GitHub pull request ever?
Yeah, I never contributed to open source before. Laravel is my first project.
All right, so there's an example of someone who had never contributed to open source before, never done a GitHub pull request before. From that to working as the first employee of Laravel within under a year, if I remember correctly, and if not under a year, very close to it. So there's a validation for what Muhammad was saying earlier about like just go do it, because like that not saying, you know, that could be every person listening, but that could potentially, you know, you young listener who's never contributed to open source, who feels like you don't have the ability to do that, you know, that's a story that could be a part of your story, whether with Laravel or somebody else. But you need to make that first pull request before that happens.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, if you have something, if you have an opinion, if you have an idea, just don't be scared to share it. If you keep it to yourself, nobody is benefited. But if you just share it, it might be useful for someone else. So just let it out there.
Yeah, I like that. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about your work and your work with Laravel and all that kind of stuff. So a couple easy questions first that a few folks from Titan wanted me to ask you. The first one was, what is your editor of choice?
PHP Store.
All right. So did you do a transition like a lot of folks do, where you go Sublime Text to PHP Storm, or was that just kind of how you got started when you started writing PHP?
Well, I started writing PHP on Front Page. It was Microsoft Front Page.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh, Microsoft Front Page. Yeah. That's a throwback.
Yeah. And then I moved to Dreamweaver, and then to Sublime, and from Sublime to NetBeans, and from NetBeans to Sublime again, and then to PHP Storm. Currently, I use PHP Storm on regular basis, but I have Sublime opened. I use it for taking screenshots because the theme there looks cool.
I love it. So what is your favorite thing about PHP Storm that makes it more useful to you than Sublime?
Well, I tried a lot of IDEs before, and I think PHP Storm is the fastest. if you're coming from a background where you're using Sublime for a lot of time, you will think that PHP Storm is slow, but it's not. I think it's very fast, and it makes writing code easier with the auto-completion and with the many helpers that the software has. So, yeah, I like it because it's fast. Like, it is fast compared to other IDEs. Don't compare it to Sublime, but compare it to other IDEs, and you will find it very fast.
Right. So once you've decided you're going to use an IDE, then it becomes the best option.
Yeah.
What is the most important or impactful thing you've learned from working together with Taylor?
Well, there is something that I didn't learn it yet, but I wish at some point I'll start to understand how he works. But like being someone like Taylor Otwell, like he's very successful in what he does. And he did a lot of very interesting projects helping millions of people. And the two projects or the three projects that are getting him income are very successful and he's doing really great. But at the same time, he didn't lose motivation. Like it's very amazing for me. Like I feel like at some point, if I get a kind of success that I'm recognized by a lot of people and that my projects are being used by a lot of people and I'm doing very well financially, by this time I think that I'll start losing motivation in building other stuff. Like I'll start just to relax and have like something like an early retirement. But Taylor, he's constantly motivated to do other things. Like he wants to build other packages. He wants to enhance the existing packages. And he just keeps searching for ideas for like new packages and how to enhance the current ones nonstop. So that's something I really wish to learn. And the thing that I really admire about Taylor and that currently I think I started to learn it is how important is details. Like everyone writes code, but Taylor not just he doesn't only write code, he writes beautiful code. Like something that when you look at it, it looks nice, it looks beautiful, it looks readable. So these are the details, and he's very, very focused on details as much as he's focused on the core of the thing he's building or the thing he's working on.
Yeah, that's a really great point. One of the things that we mentioned working with Taylor, working for Laravel, has allowed you to do was it made the move to Hergata a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. Are there other things that that working with Laravel has allowed you to do, either now or maybe that you look forward to in the future, that you think you might not have been able to do if you had stayed working for the company you were before?
Well, basically, like right now, I think as I shared, I am more secure financially in terms of money. But one of the other perks that I get when I work for or working for Laravel is that I know a lot of people right now in different countries. So I have that plan with my wife that at some point when we get a chance, we'd love to visit a lot of countries around the world. Now I made a lot of friends around the world.
Uh-huh.
So it would be really amazing to meet all these people in person and get to know their life and just not to go to the country as a tourist, but knowing them, someone in the country, it gives you the chance to live or to know the actual life of the country, not the side that tourists see. So that's one thing that I find very useful.
That's very cool. So if, let's say, and God forbid, let's say for some reason in 5 years you didn't work for Laravel, for whatever reason, good or bad, what would be your dream to do if you were kind of spun off, you were financially stable, let's say you had some savings, are you the sort where you'd want to start a consultancy? Would you want to start a product? Would you just say, you know what, I hope that I would be financially stable enough that I could just retire? Like outside of the job you have right now, which is really good, and I don't want to suggest you leaving or anything. Let's say there was some circumstance that led you to not be working there anymore. What would be the thing that you would pursue? Or do you even have anything in mind?
Well, during the past few months, I've been speaking with my wife regarding something like that. Before working at Laravel, I used to consider myself as a mid-level developer. I'm not a professional developer. I never worked for a big company or a successful company. All my past employers were like small startups or like companies that are, I have two or three developers or so. So I always thought that my next level is to try to apply to bigger companies and try to enhance myself and become a professional developer or like a senior level developer and then maybe a team leader and just the regular ladder of a web developer or a programmer. But then suddenly I found myself working for Laravel, and I always thought that that's something that I will reach when I am like maybe over my 40s or something, to work for like a big name as big as Laravel itself. So it kind of made me like a little bit confused for some time that what's next for me? What's the next step? I'm 28 years old and I don't really see myself stopping working with Laravel because I love my job very much and I love being around with all these people, speaking with them and interacting with them, trying to help and trying to find other ways to add to the community, so on and so forth. So I don't see myself leaving this job anytime soon. But like the next step, which I hope will be in like not before like at least 10 years or so, I think that I'm going to try a different profession, not even programming. Like, the thing is, I love programming and I've been doing it since I was very young, but I moving to a city where like a lot of foreigners live, I met a lot of people who just decide for like 2 years, I'm not going to work, I'm going to live on my savings. I've met like a couple of these people who just decide for a year or two just to relax or to enjoy or to experience something different. And that idea at first was like very strange to me. Like, if you are successful at your job and you are moving forward in your career, why would you stop and do something different in the middle of your like very fruitful years? But I realized that people, when they do this, when they pause, when they get a break, when they try something different, when they get back, they are more rich and they think of things in a different way. So my plan is, if at some point I have to stop working for Laravel, I think that I'll try to become a professional freediver.
Tell me more about that. Is that instruction? Is it competition? What does it look like to be a professional?
Well, I think like being in competitions or so, it's on the map. But I think that I still have a long way to go before I can go to competitions because it's a very difficult sport and it requires a lot of training. And for a free diver to be able to reach to the competition level, he have to be full-time training every day for like a long, long time. Not just I do it like I go free dive once a week. That's not enough for me to reach a level where I can compete. But definitely, I'd love to get certified and teach people free diving because I like to teach people stuff. I like to see someone who is not familiar with something, and I help him, and in a few months I see him like doing great in his in the area that I try to help him with. I like that feeling. I feel like that's something that everybody likes. I think it's not something special about me. Everyone likes to see the impact of what he does on other people. So yeah, I think that my next experiment would be something related to free diving. That's pretty much what it is.
That's cool. And that makes a ton of sense. I mean, a lot of us, I mean, even, you know, Taylor and Jeffrey and me and Adam, a lot of us have said, like, what do I want to be doing when I'm 40 or when I'm 50? Do I want to be sitting down writing code? And I don't know the answer. For some folks, the answer is yes. Some folks, it's no. Some folks, we don't know. But Jeffrey and I have often joked about being goat farmers, someday down the road. So, and I think a lot of people I know who are programmers really focus on having, like, they have a higher focus than a lot of other people on having a physical, physically creative hobby. You know, a lot of them do carpentry or woodworking or whatever else, because what we do is so much in the mind. It has so little actually kind of practical, concrete application in the physical world that sometimes we just feel like, I just want to go do something with my hands and then like see the result. And so, you know, yours isn't exactly that, but it definitely is like it's a real world, physical, tangible thing that you already love doing that lines up with your desires of teaching and stuff like that. So I mean, I empathize with that so much, and I don't live close enough to the water for that to be a thing. And I don't know that I'm as interested in free diving as you are, but the idea of being able to spend every day, in the sea sounds pretty, pretty great to me. So that makes a lot of sense. I got a couple more questions, but we're nearing the end of the interview. So one of the things I wanted to ask was, we've talked a little bit about some of the different aspects of what it looked like for people's confidence level of being a programmer in Egypt. We talked a little bit about how coming up into programming might have been a little bit different, coming up into open source, about how some of your international exposure through chat rooms have kind of changed the way, you know, you see yourself and see the world a little bit. Are there any things that we haven't covered where you can say, you know, here's some factors that make it unique to be a programmer in Egypt? That are different from what you perceive from other folks in the Laravel community that you'd want to share with us?
I'm sorry, can you rephrase that question?
Yeah. Is there anything that we haven't already talked about that is a good, or that is an interesting way that being a programmer in Egypt is different from being a programmer elsewhere, as you kind of see from the people you know?
I can pretty much say that before, like 2011, the programming scene in Egypt, it wasn't very, very fruitful. Like a lot of people, they favored like other professions than programming. But after like 2011, the Egyptian revolution, a lot of changed in the country. And one of the things that made programming pretty popular is that a lot of startups started in Egypt. And because like there was like cheap labor, like programmers in Egypt, the salaries were not as high as programmers in Europe. A lot of companies in Europe, they started companies in Egypt to control the amount of expense they have to pay. Right. So programmers became like, our programming became like one of the professions that people like look forward to and try to be, everyone is trying to become a programmer. But then after a few years, the curve changed and the mood changed. And because of the political instability and economic instability, a lot of companies shut down and they just left. And a lot of developers who are really good, they left the country and are now working in Europe or the States. So that leaves the scene here in Egypt as if it was like the past maybe 7 or 6 years weren't there. Like people are starting from the beginning right now. So I think that for everyone who's like an Egyptian programmer who's like or looking forward to try to learn more and become a better programmer, I think that the lessons learned from people who started early in 2010, 2011, they all has blogs online and they have blog posts and they talk about everything that you can just go there and read about it. And you will find a lot of information on these blog posts that will help you go through the journey even faster. I'm not sure if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, and that's a fantastic answer. So since that change has happened where it feels like a lot of those companies and even a lot of the more talented programmers have left, are you in a place where you have any other programmers or town? Are there even any meetups that you can go to, or are you kind of getting all your community online?
Well, that might sound depressing, but all my friends during the past 7 years, everyone I ever worked with who is a developer, he already left the country. So I'm the only one from my group of friends who are still in Egypt. So, yeah, it's pretty much like very, very raw right now. Like the scene right now is like how it was before, like that startup movement appeared in Egypt.
Right. That does sound a little depressing. I mean, I'm you know, the good thing is you're living in that beautiful place with your wife and getting to dive all the time. You have this great online community, but I don't want to project this onto you. But is do you have a like a priority of like seeing Egypt grow back in that direction, or is it sort of like a well, if it does, it does, and if it doesn't, it doesn't, and it's not too much of a bother?
Well, I have mixed thoughts about that, like. I wake up and I think that I want to help. I want to speak with developers in Egypt and try to actually they nobody or a lot of developers or most of the developers, the Laravel developers in Egypt, they don't know me. They don't know I work for Laravel. They are not on Twitter, and so I'm not that popular here. But I wake up and I think that I want to help. I want to speak with people. I want to try to make a meetup and teach people what I know and try to start a community. But the next day I wake up and I think that maybe it's something good, but maybe it's not someone like me who can do that. It requires a lot of energy. Yes, a lot of energy. Like I see Prosper and Neo, what they are doing in Nigeria. It's incredible. Like, these guys are heroes. They are real heroes.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of energy for you to speak with people and gather them and try to start a community. So I'm not sure if I can do it, but I definitely help anyone who is willing to do it.
Yeah.
I can help them in any way.
That's cool. And I really want to affirm what you just said, which is you can believe that the thing should happen and still decide that you're not the person to do it. That's like, I feel like that sometimes we feel the pressure that, well, it's not happening and I value it. So maybe I should have to do it. And I think that's a recipe for overcommitment and burnout. So I applaud your wisdom in being able to recognize that even though you want that to happen, you are not necessarily the one who's kind of supposed to be to actually running it. So, all right, Mohammed, I have one last question for you. As somebody who watches all the issues, all the pull requests, all the documentation, everything else that comes into Laravel, is there something, maybe a technical something, but often, or maybe just how to interact with people that you wish people would know? Is there one main thing that you say, as I watch the issues and pull requests that come into Laravel, I wish everybody knew this one thing?
I wish everybody reads the full documentation before they even start to code. A lot of people, like, they open issues and they try to ask questions while everything is already answered in the documentation. But the thing is, like, people don't believe that documentation, because they are used to documentation of other projects where things are not very clear, so it's easier to just ask the question on the forums or on the repository. But for Laravel, the documentation is very, very clear. Like, if you read the documentation, you will find a lot of missing or a lot of gems, a lot of great stuff that you can use in your project. So just I advise everyone to read the documentation from page one to the last page, and they will find themselves, like, knowing a lot of stuff that even if you are following Laracast, even if you are reading, if you already read Matt Stafford's book, the documentation is necessary. It's important because it gets updated like nearly every week with new features and with even warnings about edge cases and no fixes, things that we are unable to fix. So it's important that people should follow the documentation, should read it every once in a while, to make sure that they are on the same page with the rest of the community.
I like that. That's a very good one. And I second that too. The docs, not only were the docs always good, but Taylor has done several rounds of extensive review to make them better, clearer, more robust and easier to understand. There's as much work put in the documentation, if not more, into the actual code itself. All right, so we're basically out of time, but before we go, I want to ask, are there any things that you wish we had time to cover, whether it's technical about Laravel or things about you that you wish people knew or just that are interesting that we didn't have a chance to talk about?
Well, I won't like feel tired for hours speaking about free diving. So
yeah,
maybe next time we speak on a podcast or we meet in person, we speak about free diving a little bit more.
You know, I do, you know, it's funny because every single podcast that I've had, I tried to stop saying it. So that's why I haven't said it a million times. But I think in my head, I could talk about this one subject for hours. I think that several times during each of these interviews, and that was one of them. So I do want to ask you one question about that. You put a lot of energy, you put a lot of time into free diving. Now, granted, there's some easy, obvious wins. You know, you're in the sea. It's beautiful. You're seeing, you know, ocean life and all this kind of stuff. But I want to hear kind of from your brain, like, what is the main aspect of free diving that makes it so compelling to you?
The freedom. Like, what I feel that at the top, when you are like not in the ocean, there are a lot of rules. Like, you have to take care of how you look in front of people, mm-hmm. how you speak, how you move, and sometimes how you think. But down under, when you are like into the sea, like you go plank, your mind just stop thinking, and you enjoy the freedom that you can. You don't care how you look, you don't care how you move. Even if you are swimming wrong, nobody will be there to judge or to tell you that you are wrong, and you can pretty much do whatever you want. Like, there is something I really do. Like, if I am upset or I am mad or I don't feel like quite happy, I just, when I dive, I just go down there, like maybe like 10 meters down, and I scream. And I let it all out until like there is no air in my lungs anymore. And that's the time I come up. But that feeling of being able to do whatever you want, it's freedom. And that's the thing, the most incredible thing I love about freediving.
That's amazing. I'm really glad we at least went 5 minutes in, because I agree with you. I'd love to go for hours into that, but I don't know if I would have even begun to understand that is a part of it, because you mentioned that, and I've never done free diving, but I've swum in the ocean, and I remember one time I went lobster hunting, and it was, you know, just me just digging around and diving around, and you're right. I had no thoughts whatsoever about other people looking at me or my gait or my dress or my anything. It was my pure focus was on what was around me. And you're really right to point out that there's not a lot of context where that's the case. I think it's probably true in at least a little bit anytime we're out in nature. It's one of the reasons why people love, you know, mountains and oceans and stuff. But that's really fascinating. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, I love it so much. And I'd keep speaking about it for hours.
Yeah. Yeah, next time we will do that. So, okay, so if people are going to follow you, you are on Medium, you're on GitHub, you are on your own website on Twitter and GitHub, and they're all basically, you said, themsaid is how you say it. So themsaid, and pretty much in all those contexts, you're there. Are there any other ways people should follow you or any other projects or anything that you want to shout out?
Well, I'm on Twitter, and I like to speak with people. I like to get to know people, so just drop me a line, and I'd love to speak with you on any topic. So that's the message I want to deliver.
I love it. That's great. Well, I could talk for hours, but we're definitely hitting time now. So Mohammed, thank you so much. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for sharing all this stuff with us. Thank you for the hard work you put in for the Laravel community, and not just as work, but as like your love for helping and teaching people. Thank you for contributing that and for being a part of making the Laravel community a better place.
And thank you, Matt, for having me. And thank you for the version 3 of the podcast. I've heard the past 3 episodes, and they were really amazing. The questions you ask and how people answer, it makes you get to know people themselves, not people as programmers, the persons. So thank you for this.
Well, I'm overjoyed to hear that, and I look forward to hearing when everybody gets to learn about you as well. So, Mohammed, thank you. It was great talking to you, and I'll talk to you later.
See you later, Matt.